This is Stephen Beda, teaches at University of Oregon, and his research focuses on the environmental and political history of rural working class in Oregon. He's got a strong interest in particular in loggers now. You got a fascinating title for your prospective work, but I don't know whether to announce that, how close you are.
Oh, go ahead and announce it. It may change. It's already changed a dozen times, and it may change a dozen more before the book is already...
Well, I get to talk enough. Why don't you say what it is?
The title is Strong Winds and Widowmakers, A History of Work, Nature, and Environmental Conflict in Northwest Timber Country, 1900 to the Present.
Some of the same issues that Heather's been talking about come up in your work.
Absolutely.
And that is, well, one way of characterizing some of them is challenges to predominant values, differences, and even conflicting cultures. You're talking about environmentalists and loggers, times when they work together, times when there have been splits among them. And I want to come back to that, just announce that now, because I want to look at another very intriguing kind of theme that follows also from what Heather was saying. We think of loggers as brawny men, basically. Did they not live in community? Were there not women in their lives that were part of their political understandings, their actions?
Yeah, one of the big arguments of my book is that we can't understand the history of timber workers and timber working communities absent of women, that women were central to these communities, largely in response to the IWW. Employers, starting in the 19-teens into the 1920s, really sought to encourage married workers. They didn't want to hire single itinerant workers. A lot of the literature on logging, a lot of the folklore on Northwest logging, they always talk about these single itinerant bindle stiffs who roam from camp to camp. And that happened a little bit. But because the IWW made those workers so central to their rhetoric, employers reasoned that, well, the best way to keep the IWW out of our camps is to encourage family members or family men. And if you have families, you need schools, you need housing. So by the 1920s, most that kind of bunkhouse logging camp that most people think of, that had really ceased to exist. And most of these workers are living in company towns. Most of these workers are married. And these were very interesting, vibrant communities. There were wives of workers who had their own kind of forms of community and social networks. There were children, there were schools, and of course, there were the men who worked as well.
And women actually organized in conjunction with the male loggers.
Absolutely right. So the major union I study is the International Woodworkers of America, and they kind of saw themselves as carrying on the legacy of the IWW into the 1930s and 1940s. And my contention is that that union wouldn't exist, or at least wouldn't have been as powerful, without women. So one of the things was, a lot of these logging camps are extremely isolated. You know, they're deep in the forest. They're only accessible by a company-owned rail line. And that allowed employers to very much police these spaces and make sure no organizers were getting in, no radical literature was getting in. So women were often responsible for kind of undercover of night, helping these organizers get into town. They would often hide union literature in kind of hat boxes and stuff like that. So that's how it kind of begins, is women are kind of central to building this. And then once the IWA organized, the Women's Auxiliary played a really crucial role in drumming up support in the community for the union, as well as things like fundraising, simply feeding picket line workers, things that really allowed these early strikes and lockouts to go on. So without the women's activism, the IWA very likely would have failed in its early years.
I worked with the IWA, and one of the legacies from the Wobblies was it was the only, well, one of the only and maybe the only large union that refused to sign a contract saying they couldn't strike in the course of the contract, which in fact they drew on, they actually used.
Right.
There was a sense of direct action in resolving grievances for many, many years in the IWA. Okay, you've raised a question I want to come back to later on.
Sure.
And kind of a challenge to Heather, in fact, as I see it. And that's, were the employers right or not? I'm not going to ask you to answer this right now, about thinking that family men were somehow more docile. Heather raises this in her book in the context of who actually stuck with the movement and with the organization. But we'll come back to that later on.